This weekend, only at Macy's, it's our lowest prices of spring. How low? Diamond rings, pendants, and earrings, only $399, originally $1,500. Ninja blenders, now $89.99. And $395 men's designer suits, only $99.99. So if you're wondering why you should shop Macy's lowest prices sale, well, the name pretty much says it all. It's our lowest prices for one weekend only. Starts tomorrow at Macy's. Savings off already reduced prices. Exclusions apply.
To your soul. Let's conversation. To your soul and the
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here alone. Well, not alone, but here without Derek, because Derek is taking his, what is it, decennial vacation. Every 10 years, he's allowed a vacation. But this week, I've invited my good friend, Alex Jordan, to be the Derek of the week. Alex is a great guy, really smart guy, really funny guy. You all should follow him on Twitter. Alex, what's your Twitter name, actually? I don't remember it.
Yeah. It's Alex Jordan ATL, because I'm from Atlanta.
He's from ATL, and it's pronounced Jordan, but it's spelled Jordan because it's a Southern thing. So look up Alex on Twitter. But even more important, Alex works for the Quincy Institute, and he's the co-host of the upcoming Quincy Institute YouTube show titled Always at War, which will be coming in a few weeks and will definitely help you guys promote that. But I've already seen some preliminary episodes and it's really, really excellent. And it kind of complements our show by going a little bit more into theoretical depths at certain current events. So definitely check out Alex there. But Alex and I are going to do the news this week. So Alex, before we get into anything, thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, thanks, Danny. Thanks for having me. I'm a longtime prestige head, and you know, to go from prestige head to prestige guest, you know, don't let them tell you the American dream is dead.
The uplift is incredible. Derek's better be nervous. I know Derek's listening right now, criticizing everything you say, so you better be careful. But Alex, before we get into the news, I'm going to do Derek doesn't let me do segments, but I'm going to do gripe zone. We're entering into the gripe zone this week, and something that's actually really been annoying me, and then we could use this to get into the news. But there's been this tendency I've noticed amongst comrades, people on the left, they basically started identifying like the most extreme liberal critics of Trump as basically being correct, and that like we were all wrong on the left to quote unquote downplay Trump, and that he's actually worse than I don't think they're saying worse than Hitler, but that he's, you know, all of the nightmarish fantasies that people have had were correct, and we should have been listening to them all along. Right. And personally, I just wanted to say, and I'm curious to get your take on this, is this, I think that's almost completely wrong. I think that almost everything that Trump has been doing not only has precedent in U.S. history, but has like deep precedent in U.S. history. It's not like we have to go back to 1918 or 1828 to understand what Trump is doing, but as recently as George W. Bush, a lot of the most aggressive things regarding deporting, arresting people for political radicalism, criticizing, and again, arresting and deporting racialized others. I mean, this is in our living memory when we were but teens. So that end to me just doesn't really quite make sense. I guess Trump is definitely more vulgar and he's way more public about it and almost gleeful about it in a way that reflects the type of online cultures that have become dominant in the last 10 years. And then the one genuinely new thing that he did do, which were these incredible tariffs, basically it seems like at the time of recording that Capitol was like, I don't think you should do that. And he's like, I think you're right. So the genuinely new, like FDR type attempt to refigure the American political economy through executive action, at least for the moment, the brakes seem to have been put on that, except in terms of the China tariffs, which I think were coming for a long time anyway. I think that the Democratic Party had been pushing in this direction, maybe not quite extreme, but certainly a type of decoupling. And I think that was not necessarily linked to Trump. So I think I just want to say, and beyond that, the whole Elon Musk thing, again, at the time of recording, seems like Doge is itself being audited, which is kind of what you would expect once cabinet secretaries basically consolidate power. There's always this moment in presidential administrations when people come into office, they are put at the head of an agency and they kind of get the lay of the land. And it's not especially surprising that Elon Musk tried to, you know, kind of move through the government like he moved through tech companies, but that unsurprisingly, once these people who are not withering figures, I'm no fan of Marco Rubio or Sean Duffy, real world veteran head of the Department of Transportation.
I thought you guys were really close.
Yeah, we're bros. But one thing that, like, once these people actually consolidate hold over their bureaucracies, they're like, they're not going to just give up those fiefdoms. That's one of the ways that the American government has traditionally worked. So
well, they're
going to
defend their prerogatives.
Right, of course, because otherwise, what are they doing? I mean, these are extraordinarily ambitious people who rose to some of the most powerful positions in the country. So all this is to say, I just think that we on the left need to cool our jets about declaring victory for Blue MAGA, because I think that if we give that up too early, we might actually misunderstand what is going on and what is genuinely new about Trump, which, again, still think the jury is out. So anyway, that was a bit of a monologue, but I'm curious, what's your take on Trump, the newness of Trump, how it's different from the first term? Was Blue MAGA right? You know, Project 2025 is going to come in and institute the fourth Reich. What do you think's going on here?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, I think this week had the most like vintage Trump 1.0 vibes after he, you know, turned heel, if you will, and did the about face on tariffs, just in terms of sort of, you know, Trump was charging forward on this on his own, you know, his own theory of mind of how these tariffs would work. And then, like you said, sort of got disciplined by Capitol. I mean, he got like the Liz Truss treatment of being just like totally scared off by the bond markets. And it sounds like he was watching Jamie Dimon on Fox Business yesterday, and it sunk in that he was not going to be able to carry forward with this, you know, complete reimagination of the like global trade order and like neoliberal globalization without capital on board, or without a lot of pain, at least. You know, he was talking about taking a medicine. I think you make a really good point about just like triumphalism. And then I think it's more generally tied to the way that people exceptionalize Trump. They really want, I don't know, to maybe it's easier to imagine like defeating him politically if you make him into this like unique, never before seen figure in American history. But like you said, I think there's a lot of precedent, and it's often grasping for straws to, you know, reach across continents, reach across history to look for American antecedents to what he's doing, because they're like right here. And like you said, I mean, any of us who grew up during post 9/11 era remembers a lot of versions of what he's done. That's just not to in any way like try and what's the word I'm looking for? I'm not trying to underplay the severity of some of this.
Yeah, not to excuse him or underplay.
Yeah. But just that there are precedents, and I think the point that you've made often, you know, in the fascism debate that I think is important here is just that, you know, if you want to build a winning political program, it means having like a realistic understanding of like what you're up against. And it's probably better to, you know, have work off of like realistic historical models that make sense in the current moment and make sense in American context and the American political economy. And that's like not always 1930s Germany. it could be sometimes, but I think, I don't know. What do you think accounts for the tendency of just like needing to exceptionalize?
Well,
this
that's
guy?
What I was I going mean, to. That's what I was going to ask, right? Because that to me is the interesting question. There's like an obsession with exceptionalizing someone whose major breaks so far has really been at the level of discourse and the level of glee, which to me suggests that
aesthetics.
It's really, yeah, aesthetics, because I think to some degree, our polity is so anti-democratic that politics is played out almost totally in the realm of culture and then the realm of aesthetics.
Right.
So
right.
Things that are actually epiphenomenal now become considered to be the basis of a political move because the state structure the literal structure of the state has basically insulated major decision-making away, not only from the public, which arguably never really had a say in how things went, but even from Congress. And like in the realm that we work with in foreign policy, that's so obviously true. But I think it's also true in other issue areas, from macroeconomic decision-making to the border. The border has just been, the courts have basically just said the president can do whatever they want with the border. And that what people actually want has no say. So I think basically the closing off of democratic politics has shifted debate about politics onto the level of culture and aesthetics. And Trump is definitely new. You know, right. Like Obama was not celebrating his kill list. Obama was not celebrating, you know, killing people without due process. Joe Biden, you know, when he was like walking into walls.
He was very sheepishly killing people without due process.
Yeah, he was very sheepish. Whereas Trump is doing those very awful videos about like the Gaza River era, which is reflective of this online right-wing thing, which is to just poke the eye of the libs. And I think that is genuinely new. But I mean, even though we don't like it, we find it disgusting, et cetera, it is missing the story here, which is the actual continuities between Trump. I mean, even if you look at immigration, I was reading a 2018 LA Times piece for that This Is America piece on the fascism debate that I wrote for Jacobin. And like during 2012, 2013, like the Obama administration greatly increased like ICE raids. And this wound up to like a huge surge in the arrest of citizens and legal residents. Which, like, that wasn't the front page of the news in 2012 and 2013, Alex. I don't know if you remember, but it certainly was not. And so I think that it's this movement of politics away from real politics that is, just take the old Laswell definition, Howard Laswell definition. Politics is who gets what when, right? That's fundamentally what politics is about. It's about resources fundamentally. But because we don't have any say over that, that basically politics, what is read as political discussion is takes place in the cultural sphere, and that you actually read material things into that cultural sphere. So what do you think of that? I'm curious, as sort of a theory of this obsession with exceptionalizing Trump.
I find that very persuasive. I come from the long ago Democratic political machine, and I got pretty disgusted with it and went into the nonprofit world and doing various things. There's a take economy and an opinion economy out there that's like alive and thriving. And if you can't just rewrite the same piece about like, well, this is, you know, this is a, he's building on Obama's, you know, detention centers, and like, you know, like, you have to have a take. And so I do think that there is something to, you know, people sense, even if they do not consciously acknowledge their like powerlessness and some of these things that don't take democratic inputs. And so we have to argue about something. And so easier to argue about the like aesthetic violations and the rules and norm stuff. And again, not to say that there's not a lot of serious shit to talk about, but the question of I don't know how to diagnose it correctly gets lost in the sauce of making the most intense and loud argument. Whether or not it's like the most enlightening one is a separate question.
Yeah. And another thing that I would add to that is that focusing on that cultural sphere or exceptionalizing Trump essentially, I mean, that's what allows things like the ridiculous abundance agenda to triumph. Right. Instead of focusing on what would actually change things, which is you have to redistribute wealth. I mean, like fundamentally, right? This is what creates political coalitions in U.S. history, whether you're talking about the 1890s, the 1930s, or even the 1980s, when the Democratic Party basically recognized the stagnation of the Fordist economy, and I think to ill in the medium and long term, but basically deregulated to pump money into the system, which for a short time that happened to coincide with the adulthood of baby boomers really did lead to more money in the system and people being able to get things. But you can't do that anymore. Everything has already been deregulated. So you're actually going to have to take money out of the coffers, not only of the billionaires, but also the upper middle class, frankly. And no one wants to do that. So then exceptionalizing Trump and focusing on these other things, the other things, which again, just have, it has so much precedent, Alex. It is just like so much that it is not like difficult to find. You do like half a Google search and you see how this is just U.S. history, But focusing on the exceptionalization of it allows them to ignore, I think, the fundamental thing, which is you got to redistribute. And they're just not going to do that. So that even if the Democrats win in the midterms, even if they win in the 2028 election, I don't think they're going to be able to put together a winning coalition because they're just not going to do the thing, which is give up the money. And so they're going to, you know, turn to this threat to democracy, most important election of your lifetime, nonsense that I think is just going to work less and less and less over time. And things are just going to get shittier and shittier.
Yeah, if you keep hitting the like most important election of your lifetime button, which they've hit now like four midterm and general elections in a row, six, the people are going to stop paying attention. And I assume you haven't
never
read
have enough.
Abundance, but my understanding, as you put it, and I think it's a good one, like, I don't think it really even touches the redistribution question. Like, I think they say, well, we assume that's a part of our coalitional arrangement, but like, I think that you would probably, at least in a vulgar Marxist sense, like start at redistribution as the economic program, not have that be like an ancillary consideration or whatever. But why address material concerns?
Well, it's based it's based on this notion that growth will lift all boats, but I mean the last 50 years suggest that that actually isn't the case. And I would even say, like, to get a little theoretical, it's not real growth. Like, growth in financial markets is not like the real growth of building 19th century America.
Right.
I mean, and this is, it has become so abstract, like capital has become so abstracted that like growth on paper is not actually connected to material reality. It's essentially a form of astrology. Not to insult our astrologers here. And so that's like another big problem that no one's going to address. Like capital is just not, it's not capital in the sense that Marx was talking about, right? It's a capital he warned against. And it's actually, if you look over history, whenever economies become financialized, whether you're talking about the Dutch, whether you're talking about the British, I would argue whether you're talking about the United States, it is a sign of economic decay, actually. And so no one, the abundance bros don't talk about financialized capital. And so it makes the entire thing kind of pointless.
Right. Damn. Okay. So we got abundance. We got Trump.
the two big ones of the week.
This weekend only at Macy's, it's our lowest prices of spring. How low? Diamond rings, pendants, and earrings, only $399, originally $1,500. Ninja blenders, now $89.99. And $395 men's designer suits, only $99.99. So if you're wondering why you should shop Macy's lowest prices sale, well, the name pretty much says it all. It's our lowest prices for one weekend only. Starts tomorrow at Macy's. Savings off already reduced prices. Exclusions apply.
Let's start, Alex. You're going to be our news boy, our news man, our news gentleman.
Thank you. Please promote me.
And let's start with, why don't you walk us through what actually went on with the tariffs and tell us what's been going on with this China trade war?
Yeah. So, you know, we're recording Thursday morning. As of yesterday, Trump basically totally reversed himself, you know, a little less than a week after his Liberation Day, where he announced these sort of like broad sweeping tariffs against all different countries based on, you know, I think it's fair to say like a relatively arbitrary formula. You know, he just has undone most of it, that is to say. Like, he's put a 90-day pause on basically almost all tariffs, with some exceptions with Canada and Mexico. And then the, like, big, giant, burning exception that people don't seem to be paying enough attention to is that Trump is, like, basically diving headfirst into a full-scale trade war with China. Like, let me get the numbers here. Yeah. Okay, so Trump started with like a 34% increase on Chinese tariffs last week. That's what he announced on Liberation Day. On top of an existing average of 42% of tariffs, China in turn imposed across the board 34% increase on U.S. exports. Trump then raised tariffs on China an additional 50%, and then China said it would match that further increase. Trump then tacked on an additional 25% raise. So if you're keeping score at home, since the start of Trump's term, the U.S. has raised the tariff rates on China by 125%, and China has raised their tariffs on the U.S. goods by 84%. So, you know, China was behind only Mexico in imports to the U.S. last year. So, like, we are looking at Trump diving right into a like full scale decoupling of the world's two largest economies. And there's not a clear path to de-escalation here because we're in sort of like an escalatory spiral logic at this point. Like the White House thinks that it has, you know, escalation dominance in the economic realm with China. It thinks that Beijing is so fragile at home that it really doesn't have the leverage that it wants to have in an economic conflict. And, you know, Trump is operating off of, you know, a similar calculation to Biden, which was building, you know, alliances in in East Asia to contain China. But it's just not clear that this is going to work and that the U.S. would prevail. I mean, China has like a number of levers left in its political toolbox to deal with a trade surplus. If it's not sending all of these goods to the U.S., it still has a lot that it can do. I mean, it won't be totally ruined without the ability to get Americans to buy their cheap goods because, you know, China can still implement fiscal stimulus at home, you know, make Chinese consume more Chinese made goods, you know, work out beneficial trade arrangements with partners in the region. And, you know, we're seeing the markets like we're thrilled with Trump's reversal, but I don't think that the reality is set in that like we are going towards decoupling here. We are going to see what happens if the relationship at the key of like the last couple decades of globalization, which was the US-China relationship, is unwound. Like maybe the project looks very different at the end, and the getting from point A to point B could trigger escalation into full-scale war here. Because like the most likely outcome of decoupling between the US and China is like this terrible disruption to global supply chains, and companies, some of them will just shut down. There will be an emergence of networks to try and smuggle goods in, you know, Chinese producers seeking access to the American market and American producers like looking around for inputs that aren't there anymore. Chinese production will move probably to Latin America in some extent. But I mean, the point being that there are going to be serious, serious disruptions that will be felt acutely by Americans and American like consumers, of which we are all, and it doesn't
work. We're all proud consumers.
Yeah. First and foremost, so, I'm a consumer, then an American.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. That'd be a question. So, what do you think? So, obviously, what they're trying to do is they're trying to reshore or onshore or whatever term
right.
that you want to use. But that does seem basically impossible. So what do you think is the likely outcome of this? Are Americans just going to have to consume less or pay, you know, $3,000 for their Nintendo Switch, or is it too early to really tell?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I you know, it's hard to imagine that we're really going to settle at a place where iPhone cost $3,000. Like that seems to break a fundamental, like, you know, what's the promise left with the current arrangement that you have as like an American? It's like that you
we get to consume like pigs. That's the
exactly,
promise.
You get to consume cheap goods. So like if I'm not getting like affordable iPhone and affordable burger, like that feels like a hard thing to imagine. So, you know, you know, it's hard to imagine, but also it's hard to see where the off ramps are that are left. Like, you know, Trump is surrounded by people like military and economic advisors that are almost without exception, you know, committed to confrontation with China. It's what a lot of them have talked about, sort of reorienting the U.S. foreign policy project around. And so it's not hard to imagine how, you know, his team doesn't back off of this, even if there is real pain, real changes dealt to American consumers. And I think that there have to be if we're really going
real pain for my sham friends, champagne for my champagne real friends, for bro. My real That's friends. How I live my life.
Of course. Of course. And so like, I don't think there is an obvious off ramp. And I think both sides, you know, this is how my colleague Jake Werner put it. You know, you have mounting economic pain on both sides, surging nationalisms in both countries that become a binding force on leaders. both governments are more likely to choose destructive responses to what they regard as the other side's provocations. So, like, it is sort of the classic spiraling structure of, well, we have to do this because, you know, this is a zero-sum confrontation and the other side does the same and you keep walking up the ladder. And we can talk about it a little later with the Philippines stuff, but like this could lead to some really dangerous responses in the security realm based solely off of what was first an economic trade war or whatever. So bad news for the consumers in the short run, like very dangerous news for the cause of global peace in the medium to long term. So more uplifting stuff.
Good to hear. Let's move on to Iran and tell us about these U.S.-Iran talks that just took place this weekend.
Yeah, so on Saturday, details are a little murky, but there's going to be U.S. and Iranian officials talking in Oman. This was first announced by Trump during Bibi Netanyahu's visits to the White House this week. You know, Trump mentioned offhand that there will be direct talks with Iran. Iran sort of countered and was like, it's not direct, it's indirect. But point being, they have already, they're getting somewhere that Biden couldn't, which is like getting a conversation going with the Iranians about, you know, going back to some sort of deal to, you know, monitor and limit Iran's use of nuclear energy and potential development of a nuclear weapon. So, you know, these talks, I think they're like talks before the talks. Like it is really just setting the stage for what a negotiation could be, but there are signs that, you know, both sides seem invested in some sort of progress and both sides seem to genuinely believe the other wants to reach a deal. Like that's one difference I would say that's like kind of obvious. If you were to ask like, why is this happening now? Well, like Tehran seems to believe that Trump wants a deal. Like they were pretty skeptical about Biden. Like Biden, if you'll remember at the beginning of his term, you know, he kept Trump's maximum pressure sanctions and his whole team's thing was like, okay, well, we're going to hold on for a longer and stronger deal. We're going to get a better deal than the JCPOA to contain Iran's nuclear program. And at some point, Tehran was like, all right, well, Biden doesn't actually want a deal. He just wants to do this maximum pressure stuff. And, you know, there just wasn't ever a belief that Biden was willing to pay a political cost. And there is like a, you know, making a deal with a country that's considered one of America's official adversaries does have a political cost. And Trump seems to want a deal more than he cares about paying that political cost. And I don't know. He's got that the special mix of deal making riz and whatever you would call it.
He's a great deal maker.
Donnie deals. He loves his deals. So Tehran seems genuinely convinced that he wants a deal and therefore, you know, they're willing to offer up concessions to get this done. I mean, I don't know if you saw, did you see the Iranian foreign minister's op-ed in Washington Post?
I did not. Tell me what happened.
Yeah, so he's like, he's speaking our dear president's language. You know, he wrote this op-ed about sort of explaining the Iranian side, how they saw it. And among, you know, among the pleas he made for like why Iran would be, you know, a good partner in a deal and should get sanctions relief, which is what they're seeking. He said that Iran represents a, quote, $1 trillion opportunity in terms of access to our economy, the Iranian economy. So like he is really talking in Trump's terms about like,
yeah, give Trump a hotel in Tehran, he'll sign a deal. Like literally, yeah, I think that would be the way to do it. Yeah.
I mean, that they seem totally open to anything. And like I said, I think they're speaking his language. So, you know, if Trump is focused on, you know, achieving some sort of verification-based deal, basically like a JCPOA plus or a reskinned version of Obama's Iran deal, there's reason to be like relatively optimistic about upcoming talks, but you know, he announced this in front of Bibi, and when Bibi was in the White House, Bibi Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, and Bibi came to the White House to pitch like the Libya model for Iran, basically looking at the 2003 deal where Libya denuclearized voluntarily. You know, that's what Israel would like to see from Iran, like sort of a total putting down of their leverage here and an end to any nuclear ambitions, you know, whether that's civil nuclear energy or otherwise. In Iran, that's a non-starter for them. So, you know, Bibi has a long history of trying to sort of push America to take a side that's like doomed to fail, right? Like he wants Trump to take up a policy that Tehran will view as a non-starter. So when they get to the table, talks will blow up and they'll never get anywhere. And then Israel can continue to organize its approach to the region around sort of an anti-Iran coalition that the U.S. will back basically no matter what. This is what the deal would get in the way of. You know, if the U.S. and Iran reached a nuclear deal, it would reduce tensions in the region. It would reduce the chances of, you know, the U.S. going to war with Iran alongside Israel, because there would be real interest in maintaining something like a positive relationship. So all this is to say, like, genuinely, like, interesting and promising talks this weekend, but it's very early on. We'll see. We'll see. But, you know, I'll take something to feel okay about in this news realm when we have it.
you take the joy where it comes. Yes, let's talk about Trump talking about this potential ground invasion of Yemen.
Yeah, sure. So this is, I don't know if this has ever happened in history before. U.S. airstrikes in the Middle East are failing to achieve their desired effects. This may be unprecedented that the U.S. airstrikes aren't getting us everything we wanted. So basically, all these, you know, past couple of weeks, the U.S. has been bombing Yemen. We've killed dozens of Houthi officers. We've also killed dozens more Yemeni civilians. But the Houthi political and military structure appears pretty much intact. This might sound familiar if you paid attention to the global war on terror, when the U.S. was constantly taking out what it said was leadership rank individuals, and it didn't really have make much of a difference in terms of the groups we were actually fighting on the ground. So, you know, the Houthis have successfully launched a bunch of missiles at Israel in the past month, I think dozens of ballistic missiles. They've launched drones and missiles at U.S. ships. The U.S. has spent $1 billion approximately over these past couple of weeks fighting the Houthis. So it's not, there's very little progress. And in the face of this failure to shock and awe the Houthis, you know, out of their like political constituency, there are whispers now that the Trump team is considering providing support for Yemen's internationally recognized government in Aden in the south. That's the government that's backed by the UAE. I think it's called the Presidential Leadership Council. So this would be sort of a, you know, could spell a resumption of the civil war between the Houthis and the internationally recognized government. And the U.S. would probably, in addition to arms and logistics, they would put a, quote, handful of special forces on the ground to provide targeting support. You know, there are even rumors of like a Saudi coordinated effort, including U.S. naval support, to try and retake a port city. You know, so there's a lot of rumors and talk about what Trump might be considering. But I think generally any of our ears should perk up when like Washington think tankers are out there writing articles talking through the logistics of how to accomplish a given invasion of a Middle Eastern country. It's pretty concerning. And, you know, the U.S. has been bombing Yemen for some 23 odd years now, not always, you know, a mission related to the Houthis, but point being, you know, this does not seem to be a way to accomplish our goals. And it certainly seems to create the opportunity for the U.S. to escalate into a ground war, which I know is what people are asking for.
Is this just a supply chain thing? What is the obsession here?
I mean, that's a great question. I mean, you know, the Signalgate thing, I'm sure you saw that conversation. It was like, you know, J.D. Vance.
Bunch of cool dudes acting coolly on the internet. I mean, Jesus Christ.
Why didn't they use Discord? I would have used Discord personally. But
do you think you're on the AP Discord? Speaking of, everyone sign up for the AP Discord. Is J.D. Vance a prestige?
You never know who you may find there. But yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I think there's a pattern dependence thing. I don't know if that's the term I'm looking, but like we've been doing it before. Like, why not keep doing it? Like, I think there was, you know, Biden when he was bombing the Houthis after they were, you know, launching missiles at ships in the Red Sea and, you know, as they said, in pursuit of a ceasefire in Gaza. you know, a reporter asked Biden, you know, are the strikes in Yemen working? And he said, no, but they'll continue. And like, you know, you got all these missiles, you got all these like forward deployed, whatever, like, why not get over there? Why not make use of it? Right. Like, you have a hammer, so everything looks like a nail. So, you know, I think there's an element to that. I think there is an element to the U.S. thinking that it has this obligation as the leader of the rules-based international order or whatever to keep international shipping lanes open. But again, like, sort of complicated by Trump's tariffs, if he's really concerned about sort of the holy unity of the global trading market, I think he probably wouldn't have done this whole tariff thing the way that he did. And so it raises some questions about like what the U.S. interest that's supposed to, you know, motivate all of our military adventurisms. The interest is unclear. And I think
unclear in this case. That's good. Yeah, good stuff. Absolutely. Good stuff, Alex. Let's talk about the Israeli government and military's efforts to consolidate Gaza annexation. So, Alex, what's going on here? And also, like, I want to add, what do you think is going on? To me, this seems like endgame stuff. This seems like Israeli, the IDF is going to just occupy large swaths of Gaza kind of forever. And they're going to try to push out Gazans into other countries. But what are you thinking?
No, I think you're spot on there. You know, Israel has been, since, you know, they broke the ceasefire, they've been working to expand this area of control in the Gaza Strip from buffer zones. You know, the ceasefire had established a buffer zone along the border of Gaza that Israel has now like tried to push beyond and has pushed into the Gaza territory. In doing this, you know, proceeding slowly beyond the borders and further, and they've now gained control of more than 50% of Gazan territory, and they're raising, you know, the homes and neighborhoods in the way, and they're pushing Palestinians into the shrinking area. I think, yeah, this is right. They've pushed as far as 3 kilometers past the buffer zone into Gaza in some areas, and they are working to create a corridor across southern Gaza that cuts Rafah off entirely. So I say all this to just completely confirm what you're saying, which is like this completely aligns with how Bibi's been talking about it. Like he said, long, you know, after Hamas is defeated, Israel will control Gaza and forcibly displace Palestinians elsewhere. So this is like an endgame thing of like, all right, we've made our decision. We are doing forcible displacement, which is a war crime, and we will, you know, raise the rest of Gaza, whatever we've not already destroyed. It seems like that's the plan. And I mean, just last night, again, this is Thursday morning, but Israel overnight killed dozens of people in a strike in Gaza City, in a collapsed building. 35 upwards. Like, you know, the carnage does not stop. And it's hard to imagine that it's anything less than what you said, endgame. Like, they've got seemingly total blank check from the U.S. to keep doing this. So they're going to keep doing it, and we'll give Bibi the chance to say, I won this war. I destroyed Gaza. I put the Palestinians elsewhere. So very disturbing.
And my sense on this, I mean, I think we'll get more from the records, but Trump, my sense from what he said, he just like basically views this as an inevitability. And he basically thinks that all other U.S. presidents weren't willing to just go through with what he considers to be inevitability. He said something early on in his administration. He's like, why would they want to be there? You know, remember he said something along those lines. It's like, who could be there? Have you seen it? Like, why would you want to be there? So he just, you know, again, he's just like, he's just doing the thing that the entirety of U.S. policy has been pointing toward for decades at this point. Do you think that's a fair read of what he's doing? Just like, yeah, who's going to live there? Obviously they have to live somewhere else. I wouldn't want to live there. Would you? That's my sense of what he's doing, but what do you think?
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's you know, you don't want to get too clever with your analysis here. Like, it seems very, very straightforward that they've got the green light. And, yeah, I guess that Trump, you know, his whole thing is like stripping away pretense from American politics, right? And so like,
yeah, that's the thing. Agreed.
The pretense for a long time was that the U.S. like nominally supported, you know, something post Oslo that would look like some form of self-determination for Palestinians hypothetically down the road, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, Trump saw this for what it was, which is that like Israel is in this position to finish the job, if you will. That's like an extremely grim way to put it. But like, why is he going to step in and do otherwise? Like there was a reporting after the war early on began, you know, in like October 2023, there was reporting that I think that Netanyahu's team expected Biden to sort of put more restraint on him, on the Israeli effort in Gaza. And they didn't, you know, Biden's team rushed to get them everything they needed. And so they just were, you know, in the process of, you know, cleansing Gaza, ethnic cleansing, a genocide in Gaza, like to get what they want, to solve the issue of having Palestinians there. And they're already... they're well into this campaign, and they will pay all of these, or you know, reputational and international law consequences. I mean, they won't pay international law consequences because no one, almost no one ever does. But like,
they're not even going to really pay reputational consequences.
Yeah, maybe not.
I mean, to be honest, like, I don't really think that's even going to happen.
Right, right. No, I think that's a completely fair guess. I mean, I think it's fair to feel pretty cynical about like what the effects of launching some awful, brutal war are. So yeah, I think that it's just, it's already going. Trump can see the end game. The end game is in sight for Netanyahu. I think the question is just like, no one wants to, almost no one wants to be a part of this like forcible displacement, like the full ethnic cleansing. So how are they actually going to get this done? Are they just going to kill every last Palestinian in Gaza? Or who are they going to find that will partner with them in this effort to displace these people from Gaza for good? So we will see. But this is, I mean, so depressing to talk about. Jesus Christ.
We will see. Let's talk about the U.S.-Philippine military exercises in the South China Sea. And Alex, why don't you tell us how this could be tied to the trade war as well?
Yeah, so the U.S. and the Philippines held Operation Cope Thunder this week on the part of the Philippines closest to Taiwan. This comes after a joint U.S.-Japanese-Philippine naval exercises near the South disputed area in the South China Sea territory last week. You know, this is important. I mean, the U.S. is constantly doing military exercises with its allies and friendly nations all over the world as a sign of sort of showing our power and our capability. But these exercises take on like a real important significance under the context of the U.S. and China like diving headfirst into a trade war, because these are the sort of like regional exercises that increase tensions and can become sort of proxies and territory for escalation, and therefore like opportunities for miscalculation. Because as Beijing and Washington become focused on like winning this trade war, become focused on winning at any cost a zero-sum economic battle, both sides are presumably tempted to look outside of the economic realm to gain the upper hand, right? So they're looking to impose pain on the other side by striking more closely to their like core concerns. And so something like you know, tension between China and the Philippines over the Spratly Islands, or tension between the US and China over Taiwan can become avenues in which, you know, some smart guy in Washington or some smart guy in Beijing says, let's get at their core interest here. Let's go beyond the economic realm. Let's signal about whether or not the U.S. still believes in the one China policy. Let's signal that the U.S. is willing to back the Philippines' claims in the South China Sea with force. So like, use some sort of shifting balance in the national security realm to try and affect the outcome of the economic battle. That's how you get... That's how you get a full-on war, baby. Like, you know, it's pretty crazy. You have the Philippines and Chinese ships like ramming each other like pretty constantly in the South China Sea here. And then you have the U.S. like coming to the Philippines aid and backing, and the question of if a Philippines and China shooting war started over this dispute in the South China Sea, would the U.S., you know, come to the Philippines aid? Would it find itself in a war with China on behalf of the Philippines' claims in the South China Sea? You know, hard to say, but you could certainly imagine a scenario in when Washington thinks that it can get the upper hand in the economic war by signaling its resolve and capability in the national security realm. And that's how you get the bleed over from, like, you go from iPhone tariffs to, you know, Americans getting stationed in Korea and the Philippines to fight a land war in Asia. It sounds
a dream.
Yeah, right? I know.
That'd be so good for American prestige, Alex. I can't lie.
Anything for content. And hey, millennials, Gen Z, your life lacking meaning, wait until you get in a World War
III. Wait until you're on the shores of Kaesan.
Exactly. A new Cold War, as the AP fans will know it.
So speaking of, why don't we talk a little bit now about South Korea and Yoon leaving office?
Yeah, so South Korea's constitutional court has upheld the impeachment of Yoon. If you'll remember, he declared martial law and deployed troops to the National Assembly in sort of this like auto coup that had sort of slow motion political huge ramifications for him. He got impeached. So attention is now turned towards June, where we have these snap elections, and the opposition Democratic Party leader, Jae Myung, is like presumed to win. He's got a pretty serious lead in the polls. Is Lee Jae Myung. Yeah, he's a self-styled realist. So he's something of like a moderation in the South Korean foreign policy realm. Like, you could see him converging with Trump on some sort of efforts to dial down tensions with North Korea. But there's also definitely territory for disagreement. Like, you know, Trump is presumably going to try and rope all of America's allies in East Asia into this trade war with China. But they're not going to be on board to varying degrees, particularly countries like South Korea, which have like extreme economic interdependence with Beijing. So, you know, he's not going to be on board for that side of the agenda. And he also is like, it doesn't seem like he would be pushed into taking the U.S. stance on Taiwan, which is like a critical part of how the U.S. approaches the region. So, you know, could agree with Trump on some of the, you know, dialing down tensions with North Korea, but likely to disagree with him on the tariff side and on the Taiwan stuff. And so, you know, this is part of what makes this interesting is this auto coup that that Yoon did, like, has basically removed Korea from the table for the past few months in terms of how Trump has approached Asia. There just hasn't been like another party that he's dealing with that speaks for the South Korean political system or whatever. So we'll be interesting to see once, you know, Lee or whoever wins in June comes into power, how Trump will try and actually instrumentalize that allyship towards China. Because I mean, come June, and we're in April, we'll see. Hopefully we're no longer in a full-scale trade war, but like presumably we will be, and the U.S. will be scrambling for every ally it can get, and, you know, trying to build this coalition against China. So
yeah, we'll it's interesting because I don't think Trump gives a shit about the U.S.-China security thing, which has really obsessed Americans, but he really cares about the trade war, which did not obsess American presidents. So it's kind of like a reversal here. Because like when I think the previous American presidents were like, okay, the trade will continue. Great, 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 great.
Right.
The issue is Taiwan. For Trump, it's the opposite. Trump, I think Trump would give Taiwan in a second if they allowed him to build, you know, a Trump hotel in Taipei. Not quote unquote give, being sure, a big glib, people know what I mean, but like it's the trade war is really the focus. So it's kind of an inverse of the way that we've normally understood the U.S. relationship to the region in China.
Well, that's super interesting too, because like, you know, the Taiwan question is always of vital interest to Beijing. You know, they've made it very clear for a long time that that's like a core concern in the U.S. relationship. And, the, you know, U.S. presidents have had like various affinity there, but Trump is going after something that Americans at home actually care about. Like Americans at home, I don't think really give a lot of care about
cheap TVs, yeah,
about like the one China policy and like maintaining it, but they do care about like how the US, you know, even if they don't know it, the US-China economic relationship definitely touches their lives. So going after something more like fundamentally at heart for Americans, yeah, I just like that we are in the fun zone or whatever you might call it of like a genuinely, you could see a lot of different outcomes a month from now and not none of them would be shocking, but a lot of them would be pretty bad. So buckle up.
Let's talk about Mexico.
Yeah, sure.
And this drone strike situation.
Look, if you weren't getting enough drone strikes already, you're going to love this one. NBC News says that the Trump administration is reportedly considering drone strikes against Mexican drug cartels to combat trafficking across the border. You know, Trump's team is like very focused on very serious, you know, fentanyl issues. But I'm not quite sure that ramping up the drug war this way is really going to change the reality of like American demand for opiate-based care or addiction or what have you. So if we started droning cartels, that would be an escalation. The U.S. obviously like doesn't have, you know, Trump wouldn't be operating under legal authority, certainly would not ask Congress to wage war on Mexico, but presumably would invoke some sort of national security rationales for ending, you know, the flow of fentanyl into the country. Again, serious problem. Very hard to imagine how it will be solved by going to war with like with Mexico's like very militarized cartels who have, you know, serious capability, not unlike a lot of other like groups that the U.S. thinks that it can like bomb out of being a problem. Claudia Sheinbaum, president of Mexico, is like coming out very strongly against U.S. unilateral action. I think Sheinbaum has like done a pretty good job playing ball with Trump in terms of like trying to pursue Mexico's interests while like not totally welcoming hellfire on Mexico like other countries' leaders have made Trump irate. And you know, Mexico can't afford to have like this super contentious relationship with the US and like be at complete odds with them, but it's hard to imagine how the US bombing the hell out of like parts of Mexico wouldn't create serious issues in that realm. So Sheinbaum is like, you know, pushing all sorts of various like legislative challenges, like trying to create the groundwork for like Mexico will resist this kind of action. And part of the concern here is, I mean, the CIA is stepped up pretty heavily its surveillance of cartels, as we understand it. They're flying all these drone surveillance operations over Mexico, monitoring the movement of fentanyl. And, the U.S. certainly has, it can inflict some serious pain and hardship, but that's separate from like solving the issue at hand. And it would create all sorts of like blowback at the border. And, you know, it's a large border. There can be like a lot. There's a lot of negative externalities, which is the name of the game with U.S. foreign policy, apparently these days. Or sorry, always.
Well, Alex, at least drugs will stop being used. So of course, can't
this will
that.
Solve yeah. the demand problem. Whyever it is that America, we're like the number one consumer of drugs by like a lot, right? Like, yeah. So I'm sure this will. I'm sure this will.
It'll end it. Yeah. We'll be good. We'll be living in Nancy Reagan's Fantasia soon enough. So let's end on a lightning round on Ukraine. And let's talk about this. Ukrainian government has been making hay that a Chinese national has been fighting in the war. Yeah. What is Ukraine trying to do? What's the real story?
Yeah, so Zelensky has accused Russia of recruiting Chinese nationals to fight in the war. There were a couple of troops that Ukraine has like recorded and like made some pretty slick video of you know, appear to be folks with Chinese passports or Chinese nationals who are fighting on the Russian side. Zelensky's claim that this is like systematized, and you know that the Russian government is seeking this out or promoting this. I think that's a little harder to say. I mean, there are mercenaries fighting on both sides of this war. Like, there's not a shortage of like Americans who are doing adventure. You know, Malcolm Nance, friend of the pod, you name it. Like, there's a serious international legion fighting on Ukraine's side, and then there are definitely similar like adventurism for people from different countries who want to fight on Russia's side, and that would include Chinese. I think it wouldn't be shocking if, you know, that number 155 that they were promoting, that was from the Zelensky government. It seems like plausible. I think the broader claim, though, that this is some sort of like state-sponsored effort is a little harder to say for sure. I mean, you know, China is a lot of people. It's not hard to imagine how 155 could have escaped across the border, found their way to get a gun and get on the battlefield. U.S. officials themselves are also, you know, have told reporters they're doubtful this is state arranged. So this last week, there's a strike that missile strike at a playground in Zelensky's hometown, that it looks like it was the most deadly attack, at least, you know, in terms of children, civilian casualties. Right now, it's saying upwards of 9, and the images are pretty harrowing. Like, it's a big crater right next to the playground equipment. I think, you know, this is not the first nor probably the last story of like awful civilian toll, particularly that Ukraine has paid during Russia's invasion. And I think there's a lot of upset. Trump reacted and, you know, sort of bemoaned that Russia seems to keep doing these strikes. You know, these negotiations are not set or finished for this partial ceasefire. But there is some, like, I think, off the table expectation that maybe some sides will dial it down in the interim. But I don't think either side is actually doing that in reality. But that's sort of the fight in the press. And so anyway, you know, these strikes are awful. And this latest strike was awful. And I think it probably, I mean, to me, underscores why you need negotiations, right? Is that like, there are all sorts
of... If you don't, Russia, this will just keep on happening. Yeah.
Exactly. Russia was trying to... they say they were trying to strike like a nearby place where there was some sort of... there was like a military meeting or whatever. I mean, whether or not that is what they thought they were doing, they ended up killing a bunch of Ukrainians, a bunch of Ukrainian kids, devastating all these families. And like, they're this story told over and over again through the war, and it doesn't stop until there's a negotiated ceasefire. And Ukraine can't stop rebuilding until it knows that those missiles won't constantly be getting lobbed into the cities or whatever. And it just, it's so years past time that a ceasefire happened. But the actual...
Yeah, and once again...
Yeah, go ahead.
A shame on those who argued against the ceasefire. Shame on those Americans who did that. Eternal shame.
No doubt.
So let's conclude with Ukrainian negotiators were actually in D.C. to talk on the infamous or famous mineral deal.
Yeah, we don't have a lot of details out of this yet, but the reason I thought it's worth talking about is just to give a lay of the land on diplomacy. Basically, you know, there's a technical team in Washington this week talking about what it would look like for the U.S. to possess some amount of Ukrainian minerals after this war is done. This mineral talk is, you know, seemingly, you know, it's detached from the conversations about these infrastructure ceasefire, but it does seem to be a part of sort of the core ask for Trump, is that U.S. gets some mineral rights, gets, you know, the U.S. gets a get out of this war, which is, to be clear, not the justification that Biden was using. Biden was saying we were at this war just because, you know, we're a proxy to this war just because of our like dutiful dedication to democracy or whatever. But this feels like the bill was always going to come due when the negotiations were done, because the U.S. very, very rarely acts out of its own, you know, benevolence, no matter how much it says that. They're looking into this deal that would mean signing over a significant amount of mineral rights to the U.S., you know, presumably as payment back for, you know, the billions and billions of military aid and all the logistical and otherwise, you know, military support. and it seems kind of inevitable. I mean, this is sort of a part of what people were warning about when it came to needing negotiations sooner versus later, is that Ukraine is in this position between, you know, being invaded by Russia and being backed by a U.S. power that really wanted to encourage it to fight as long as it wanted to, as long as its political leadership wanted to, more specifically. And so, the Ukraine got in this position where it needs more from America than America needs from Ukraine. And so it's going to be forced or coerced or put in a position, maybe is the best way to put it, to sign away, you know, serious economic
interests. It's beautiful minerals.
Yeah, it's beautiful minerals. And, you know, there's already been like a pretty serious campaign of state privatization by U.S. companies. And, you know, this whole question of what it looks like to rebuild Ukraine, I think, you know, Trump sees certainly economic upside there that he wants to exploit. And then whether that's the same as like upside for the Ukrainian people is a very separate question, because they're at a pretty sorry state right now. They're the world's lowest fertility rate. You know, they have millions and millions of Ukrainians abroad who may not ever return. They have to have something to return to and a reason to return. And sort of the question of what Ukrainian life will look like after this war, you know, the prospects get grimmer month by month. And this deal is going to mean certainly some sort of U.S. investment in Ukraine. And that means some amount of stability, presumably, in a part of negotiations. If the U.S. has economic interest in Ukraine, that also means, you know, constructing a deal that deters or discourages Russia from any sort of reinvasion or restart of the conflict. But it's hard to say when that will come about, because there's still plenty of forces, you know, in Ukrainian society, you know, that don't want the settlement. I mean, including Zelensky for his own political benefit. It seems like when the war is over, his political career is over. So there's a lot of like challenges to getting there. But I think ultimately we should be happy to see some amount of conversation about what a settlement will look like, because you know, there will be a painful settlement coming. It seems painful for Ukraine. So they're going to be in a better position the sooner that sort of gets structured out. So that's my last
good news all really around.
Yeah, right. Jesus. I wish that I had something cool or fun or uplifting to talk about, but this is how every AP episode ends. Look at the world. Look at
exactly.
This world.
So you're fitting right in. All right, everyone, follow Alex on Twitter. It's Alex Jordan ATL, even though it's pronounced Jordan. It's spelled Thank Jordan.
Thank you for honoring my Southern heritage.
I'm honoring your Southern heritage. I'm not sure that's always the thing to be most proud of.
No, definitely not.
But and everyone, keep an eye out for Alex's show, which he's going to co-host with Courtney Rawlings, titled Always at War, YouTube show. I think you're all really going to like it. I've already seen some early episodes and they're excellent. That'll be coming out soon. We'll let you know about that. And Alex, thank you so much for guesting at AP. I know Derek is currently sitting on a beach somewhere sweating about your work here.
Oh, he deserves the Mai Tai that he's drinking. He's earned it. I would never supplant the dear boy Derek, but it's been a pleasure to try and do my best Derek impression here.
All right, thanks everyone, and as always, keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.
This weekend only at Macy's, it's our lowest prices of spring. How low? Diamond rings, pendants, and earrings, only $399, originally $1,500. Ninja blenders, now $89.99. And $395 men's designer suits, only $99.99. So if you're wondering why you should shop Macy's lowest prices sale, well, the name pretty much says it all. It's our lowest prices for one weekend only. Starts tomorrow at Macy's. Savings off already reduced prices. Exclusions apply.